Mimi Ma sits in the auditorium's second row, transfixed by something the tree woman just said. Patricia Westerford. The five of them shared her discoveries over campfires back when the free bioregion of Cascadia was still a place. Her words made them real, those alien agents doing things beyond the narrow consciousness of humans. The woman is older than Mimi imagined, frightened and faltering, and there's something wrong with her speech. But she has just delivered this fine, sane, but somehow taboo rule. What you make from a tree should be at least as miraculous as what you cut down. What the forest makes of the mountain is better than the mountain. What people might make of the forest. The thought barely germinates when Dr. Westerford jolts Mimi back.
I've asked myself the question you brought me here to answer.
Mimi's first thought is that she's mistaken. A distinguished researcher and author, someone who has spent decades saving seeds from the world's endangered trees. It can't be happening. She must be wrong.
I've thought about it based on all the evidence available. I've tried not to let my feelings protect me from the facts.
The whole soliloquy is a piece of theater, heading toward some last-minute reverse or reveal.
I've tried not to let hope and vanity blind me. I've tried to see this matter from the standpoint of trees.
Mimi looks down her aisle. People sit in disbelief, pinned in their seats with the full weight of shame.
What is the single best thing a person can do for tomorrow's world?
Another woman once asked Mimi this, and the answer, so obvious, so reason-driven, burn down a luxury ski resort before it could be built. The plant extracts hit the glass. Green spreads through the water, snaking like a time-lapse bud sped up 100,000-fold. Mimi, 40 feet from the podium, can't move. Dr. Westerford lifts the glass like a priest raising a sacrament. Her speech thickens to a paste.
Many living things choose their own season. Maybe most of them.
It's happening. It's real. But hundreds of the world's smartest people hold still.
You asked me here to talk about home repair. We're the ones who need repairing. Trees remember what we've forgotten. Every speculation must make room for another. Dying is life, too.
Dr. Westerford glances down, and Mimi is waiting for her. She locks on to the tree woman's gaze and won't let go. Long ago, in another life, she was an engineer and could make matter do so many things. Now she knows only this one skill, how to look at another being until it looks back. Mimi pleads, her eyes burning.
No, don't, please.
The speaker frowns. Everything else is hypocrisy.
You're needed for this. We are too many.
That's not for you to decide.
A new city the size of Des Moines every day.
What about your work, your seed vault?
It has run itself for years.
There's so much more to do.
I'm an old woman. What better work than this is left?
People won't understand. They'll hate you. It's too theatrical.
It will get a moment of attention amid all the screaming.
It's immature, not worthy of you.
We need to remember how to die.
You'll die horribly.
No, I know my plants. This one will be easier than most. I can't watch this again.
Watch again. It's all there is.
The glance lasts no longer than it takes a leaf to eat a chunk of light. Mimi fights to hold the speaker's gaze, but with a last act of will, the tree woman breaks away. Patricia Westerford lifts her gaze back onto the cavernous room. Her smile insists that this isn't defeat. It's use by another name. A small thing, a way to buy a little more time, a few more resources. She glances back down at a horrified Mimi.
The things we might see, the things we could still give.
There's a beach in Ohio Patricia would like to see again. Of all the trees she'll miss like breathing, a simple, smooth-boled beech with nothing special to it except a notch on its trunk 4 feet up from the ground. Maybe it has thrived. Maybe the sun and rain and air have been good to it. She thinks,
maybe we want to hurt trees so much because they live so much longer than we do.
Plant Patty raises her glass. She scans her speech for the last line on the last page.
To Tachygalli versicolor.
She looks up. 300 brilliant people watch her, awed. The soundtrack is silent, except for muffled shouting by the lip of the stage. She glances over at the commotion. A man in a wheelchair rolls up to the right-hand stair. His hair and beard flow down around his shoulders. He's as thin as the talking tree person of the Yaqui, the one no one could understand. Alone of all the people in this paralyzed room, he pushes down against his chair, trying to stand. The green liquid splatters over the glass's lip into her hand. She looks again. The man in the chair waves wildly. His twig arms fling outward. How can something so small matter so much to him? The single best thing you can do for the world. It occurs to her, the problem begins with that word, world. It means two such opposite things. The real one we cannot see, the invented one we can't escape. She lifts the glass and hears her father read out loud,
"Let me sing to you now about how people turn into other things."
Nile's shouts come too late to break the room's spell. The speaker raises her glass, and the world splits. Down one branch, she lifts the glass to her lips, toasts the room,
to Tachygalli versicolor, and drinks.
Down another branch, this one, she shouts,
"Here's to unsuicide!"
and flings the cup of swirling green over the gasping audience. She bumps the podium, backs away, and stumbles into the wings, leaving the room to stare at an empty stage. In the spring, the lush, too warm spring, when the buds and flowers go mad on every dogwood and redbud and pear and weeping cherry in the city, Adam's case at last runs out of delays and heads to a federal court on the West Coast. Reporters fill the courtroom like ants swarming a peony. The bailiff leads Adam in. He's stocky now, bearded. Furrows contour plow his face. He wears the suit he last wore to the awards banquet where he accepted his university's top teaching prize. His wife is there, seated in the row behind him, but not his boy. His boy will only ever see his father like this many years later, on video. "How do you plead?" The psych professor blinks, as if he's another form of life altogether, and human speech is way too fast to understand. Over the empty sill, Through the kitchen window, Dorothy Brinkman looks out onto a jungle. The man who never once failed to feed a parking meter has launched her on a made-to-order revolution. The Brinkman Woodlands Restoration Project. Wildness advances on all sides of the house. The grass is foot-high, clumped, weedy, seeding, and thick with native volunteers. Maples pop up everywhere, like paired hands. Ankle-high hackberries flaunt their paisley leaves. The speed of the reclamation stuns her. A few more years, and their stand of woods will half reprise whatever came before the invading subdivision. Her own second growth is even faster. Once, long ago, she jumped from airplanes, played a bloody-minded murderess, did terrible things to anyone who tried to confine her. Now, she's almost 70, at war with the entire city. Jungle in an upscale suburb. It's up there with child molesting. The neighbors have come by on 3 separate occasions to ask if there's anything wrong. They volunteer to mow for free. She plays herself, sweet, demented, just adamant enough to hold them at bay. A last amateur theatrical comeback tour. Now the whole street is ready to stone her. The city has written twice, the second time a registered letter giving her a deadline to clean up the place or face a fine of several hundred dollars. The deadline has come and gone, and with it another threatening letter, another deadline, and another assessed fine. Who would have thought the foundations of society would be so shaken by a little runaway green? The new deadline is today. She looks out on the chestnut, the tree that shouldn't be there. Last week she heard a radio story about how 30 years of crossbreeding has at last produced a blight-resistant American chestnut tree about to be tested in the wild. The tree that seemed to her like a spared memory now looks like a prediction. A flash of orange at the window catches her eye. American redstart, male, flushing insects from the thicket with its tail and wings. 22 species of birds this last week alone. 2 days ago, at twilight, she and Ray saw a fox. Civil disobedience may cost them thousands in compounding penalties, but the view from the house has been much improved. She's making fruit compote for Ray's lunch when the awaited angry knock comes on the front door. She flushes with excitement. More than excitement, purpose. A touch of fear, but the most delicious kind. She rinses and dries her hands, thinking, here I am, near the finish line, loving life again. The knock gets faster and louder. She crosses through the living room, reviewing in her head the defense of their property rights that Ray has helped her prepare. She has spent days at the public library and the municipal building, learning how to read local ordinances, legal precedent, and municipal code. She has brought back copies to her husband for explanation, one stunted syllable at a time. She has pored through books, compiling stats on just how criminal mowing, watering, and fertilizing are, just how much good a reforested acre and a half can do. All the arguments of sanity and sense are on her side. Against her, there is only one unreasoning and primal desire. But when she opens the door, it's on a scrawny kid in jeans and polo shirt, stringy blonde hair sticking out from under his made-in-the-USA ball cap, and the whole plan of defense changes. Mrs. Brinkman? Behind the kid, out by the curb, 3 even younger boys, shouting back and forth in Spanish, unload lawn equipment from a pickup truck and flatbed trailer. We're here from the city to clean up your place. We'll only take a few hours, and the city won't bill you until later. No, she says, and the rich, warm, wise sound of that single syllable confuses the boy. He opens his mouth, but he's way too baffled to make it say anything. She smiles and heaves her chest.
You really don't want to do that. Tell the city that would be a terrible mistake.
She remembers the secret from her days on stage. Mobilize your inner will. Summon all the memory of a life lived. Hold it in your head. Right and wrong. The truth, self-evident. Nothing has more power than simple conviction. The boy wavers. The city failed to prepare him for such authority.
Well, if it's all right,
she smiles and shakes her head, embarrassed for him.
It isn't all right. It really isn't.
You know better. Please don't make me shame you even worse. The boy panics. She looks at him with affection, understanding, most of all, pity, until he turns away and calls the crew and the gear back into the truck. Dorothy shuts the door and cackles as they drive away. She always did enjoy playing a good madwoman. It's the smallest of victories, the slightest postponement. The city will be back. The mowers and clippers will set to work, next time swarming without asking. They'll shave the yard clean. The fines will pile up with the late fees and penalties. Dorothy will countersue, fighting in court until the last appeal. Let the city confiscate the house and throw a paralyzed man in jail. She will outlast them. The anarchy of new seedlings and next spring is on her side. She heads back to the kitchen, where she finishes making lunch. She feeds Ray, telling him about the poor boy and his foreign work crew who never knew what hit them. She acts out all the parts. The most fun is playing herself. She can see him smile, although no one else in the world would be able to confirm. After lunch, they work the crossword. Then, as he often does these days, Ray says,
"Tell more."
Dorothy smiles and climbs into bed next to him. She looks out back, through the window, on the riot of new growth. In its middle, the tree that shouldn't be there. Its branches rush outward, toward the house, slowly to be sure, but fast enough to inspire her. How life managed to add imagination to all the other tricks in its chemistry set is a mystery Dorothy can't wrap her head around. But there it is. The ability to see all at once, in all its concurrent branches, all its many hypotheticals, this thing that bridges past and future, earth and sky. She's a good girl, you know. She takes her husband's stiff claw. She was just lost for a little while. All she needs to do is find herself, find a cause, something bigger than she is. The prosecution shows photos from the scene of one of the man's alleged crimes. A bit of graffiti on a charred wall. The first letters of each line sprout tendrils and vines, like the capitals of an illuminated manuscript. Control kills. Connection heals. Come home or die. It's the centerpiece of their case, the grounds for the extraordinary sentence they're demanding. They mean to prove intimidation, an attempt to influence the conduct of government by force. Adam's lawyers argue for mercy. They claim the fires were set by a young idealist calling the public's attention to a crime against everyone. They say the sales of the forest were themselves illegal, and the government failed to protect lands entrusted to it. Countless peaceful protests had come to nothing. But they have no case. The law is clear on every count. He's guilty of arson. Guilty of destruction of private property, guilty of violence against the public well-being, guilty of manslaughter. Guilty the jury of Adam Apich's peers concludes, of domestic terrorism. The law is simply human will written down. The law must let every acre of living earth be turned into tarmac, if such is the desire of people. But the law lets all parties have their say. The judge asks, "Would you care to address any final words to the court?" Thoughts ring Adam's head. The verdicts have cut him loose, like windthrow or fire. Soon we'll know if we were right or wrong. The court sentences Adam Apich to 2 consecutive terms of 70 years each. The lenience shocks him. He thinks, 70 plus 70 is nothing. A black willow plus a wild cherry. He was thinking oak. He was thinking Douglas fir or yew. 70 plus 70. With reductions for good behavior, he might even finish out the first half of the sentence just in time to die.